Training people who not only will leave, but may also become your competition is, how shall we say it, de rigueur in Eric's restaurant? That's my nod to his French heritage. Ultimately, those young chefs one day will become better than us, Eric told me. The new generation that we see coming is already showing signs of extreme talent. It's a logical progression from generation to generation. Bring the brick, they step on it, they go higher. My generation learned from the talent and the generosity of our mentors, and we did what we do today. And now, there is a new generation. There will be many generations to follow that will do the same thing, and that makes us happy. It's nothing to be worried about. It's a natural part of life. How can you know what another person hopes to someday do? Easy. Ask. And if you are a boss, employees will care about your company only after you have shown you care about them. One of the best ways to do that is to not just say, but show that while you have hopes for your company's future, you also have hopes for your employees' futures. While we're at it, working your number can also be fun. Success strategies don't have to be used separately. You can and should blend two or more together when doing so will result in greater success, greater motivation, and even greater success. For example, let's use a time-specific form of work your number in conjunction with an extreme productivity day. Let's choose a goal that might seem odd at first, but proves that working your number can be applied to almost anything. And let's learn, by my example, a few things not to do. I started with a simple premise, one we discussed a few minutes ago when we talked about Jack Welch, the generosity gene, and ways you can be more giving. The idea was that no one gets enough praise. No one gets enough recognition. Few of us praise and recognize people as often as we should. I know I don't. So in the spirit of challenging myself, I decided I would compliment every person I ran into for an entire day, even if I ran into them only in passing, even if I didn't know them, even if it didn't seem socially appropriate, and even if I had a tough time thinking of something, thinking of anything I could compliment them for. While that might sound easier than doing 5,000 push-ups, for me it wasn't. I'm shy. I don't go out of my way to speak to people I don't know. You might even argue that I go out of my way not to speak to people I don't know, and you might win that argument. Here's how that little experiment went. My rules. Challenges work best when you impose structure, helping you stay on track and reducing the temptation to lose resolve and rationalize that you should change your goal midstream. For this challenge, the structure was simple. If I made eye contact with someone, I had to compliment them in some way. To make sure I never chickened out, I had to actively try to make eye contact. I couldn't intentionally look away. But I didn't have to compliment people who were already having a conversation or on the phone or wearing headphones. I didn't want to be rude. And I couldn't hide away all day. I had to go out into the world at least four times. So, with that in mind, my morning. The first few compliments were really easy. I was rolling a trash can out to the street and saw my neighbor. She has a great collection of plants and flowers, so I said, I'm always impressed by how beautiful your plants are. You have a real gift. Her face lit up. I don't think I made her day, but I do think I helped get her day off to a good start. Then I went for a quick walk on the beach. Because this was fall, many of the people I met were walking their dogs or throwing balls into the surf for the dogs to retrieve. You have a beautiful dog, I said to the first person I walked by. He smiled, but I realized I had complimented his dog, not him. Although many dog owners don't see a difference, still rules are rules. So I followed up with, she seems so happy. You must take really good care of her. He beamed, and I realized I was right. Complimenting a person's dog, or child, or car, or whatever, is nice, but complimenting the person makes a bigger impact. So that's what I did. I told one man he had done an amazing job training his dog. I complimented a lady on how well she groomed her dog. I was rolling. I felt pretty darn smug. This compliment every person you meet thing was easier than I thought. Then, off in the distance, I saw a fit, pretty, 20-something woman headed my way. No dog. No third-person-ish thing to compliment. Uh-oh. I didn't want to be that guy. That older guy who goes around randomly complimenting young women and comes off creepy and, well, icky. I started to walk more slowly. I thought furiously, but I had nothing. Crap. Then, from about 20 feet away, she made eye contact and smiled. Not a half smile, not an automatic good morning smile, but a big, genuine smile. I smiled back and said, "Thanks." "For what?" she said. Lots of times when I'm walking, people don't even make eye contact. I always think that's kind of rude. You saying hi to me was really nice. She smiled even bigger and said, "How could I not be happy when I'm out here? Have a great day." I know what I came up with was lame, but I like to think she walked away feeling good about herself, if only for a moment or two, which was the whole point of the exercise. And I felt pretty good about myself, too, at least until later, when I came upon a woman and her child and led with, "Your daughter is really cute," only to be told, "Thank you, but he's a boy." Oh, well. My afternoon. Except for a few miscues, by this point I was rolling. I had learned to quickly size people up and pick out something obvious I could compliment. How they cared for their animals, how they landscaped their yards, even how they dressed. I even managed to whip out a, "That is such a pretty sweater. I wish I had your fashion sense." And to my surprise, the nice lady took it well. Then I went to the grocery store. And let's just say that no one in a grocery store expects you to walk by and compliment them, not even the people who work there. And let's just say that, "Wow, you picked the perfect melon," isn't the right way to go. And neither is, "You look like you're on a mission. You seem extremely well organized." And, "I wish I was as good at choosing the right steaks as you are," falls pretty flat. And let's just say, I wanted to give up. In some settings, it seemed, compliments are not just unexpected, but also unwanted. Still, I decided to try one more time, but with a twist. I decided to ask for help, because asking for help is implicitly complimentary. If I ask you for help, I'm saying you know something I don't know, or you can do something I can't do. Asking for help is like saying, "I respect your knowledge, skill, experience." That's what I did. I was in the seafood section and made eye contact with a 30-something woman. She didn't smile or nod. Gulp. But I forged ahead. "I'm terrible at picking the right piece of salmon," I said. "Can I bother you for a second and ask you to help me?" And she did. In fact, she appeared to enjoy it. And I got to say, "I really appreciate it. Thanks for helping me and for being so nice." So while I did experience a couple of tough moments, especially when I found myself standing in the checkout line behind an extremely frazzled father with three borderline out-of-control kids, and the last thing he seemed to want was a random compliment, I made it out of the grocery store and out of the parking lot with my compliment streak intact. But I do have to admit, I was relieved to get back in the car. My evening. Dumb move number two. I went to the gym. On one hand, it was easier. Most people wear headphones when they work out, so that eliminated them from my challenge. On the other hand, moving from bench to machines to free weights meant that I ran into almost everyone who was at the gym. Still, one guy was benching 325 pounds for reps. Easy compliment. A woman was doing a split and then laying her torso all the way forward onto the mat. Another easy compliment. A guy jumped in and helped an apparent newcomer with his form on squats. Presumptuous, yes, but also kind, because the way the guy was bending his back was a recipe for injury. When I ran into the Good Samaritan a few minutes later, it was easy for me to say, "That was really nice of you to help him out." Then I found myself doing pull-downs near a guy doing seated rows. And I had nothing. Until I noticed the tattoo on his forearm. And I was in. "I really like your tattoo," I said. He smiled, said thanks, and then spent the next 5 minutes talking all about it, where he got it, how he came up with the design, what it meant to him. I realized that sometimes the easiest thing to compliment is the thing that people seem to want you to notice, or are obviously proud of. A tattoo, a piercing, an unusual hair color, a Porsche, a Hayabusa, a tricked-out truck. Almost everyone has something they do or say or wear that they feel represents who they are inside. All you need to do is look for it. My takeaways. I can't say it was easy. Complimenting every single person I ran into got easier, but never easy. It's not hard to compliment people you meet who are doing their jobs. Grocery clerks, managers, front desk people at the gym. Saying thanks and telling them they did something well is not difficult at all. All that's required is that you remember to actually do it. Complimenting random people is harder, but surprisingly rewarding. It was fun to watch people's faces light up. Try it. You'll think so too. Every day, people around you do good things. Most of those people don't work for you. In fact, most of them have no relationship with you, professional or personal. Compliment them for something they would least expect. Expected feels good. Unexpected makes an even bigger impact. Don't just take my word for it. Complimenting people who try something different can also be hard. Do it anyway. Status quo is often status safe. Taking a risk, however small, is hard, especially if you're insecure. Insecurity feeds off silence. So mention when you see someone trying something different. Compliment the effort. Praise the risk. Even if what they have tried doesn't work, they will know you noticed. Everyone likes to be noticed. And they'll know, regardless of how it turns out, that you respect them for trying. Most of all, make the compliment personal. Compliment what the person did to achieve a certain outcome, not the outcome itself. And never be afraid to ask for help, because the act of asking is a compliment in itself, and it gives you the chance to praise that person for his or her knowledge and skill. Give it a try. Make tomorrow an extreme productivity day where you work your number and make that number praise. Commit to complimenting 5 people, or 10, or even everyone you meet. Other people will appreciate it. Research shows that more people leave a job due to a lack of recognition than for any other reason. Statistics show that children are happier, more motivated, and more successful when they receive regular encouragement and specific praise. And no science is needed to know that the faces of your family and friends light up when you compliment them. Then, you can use that gratification and fulfillment to motivate you to try the next strategy, because while it works, it is definitely not easy. Why? Because you'll need to do what the pros do. Chapter 7. You don't need a coach. You need a pro. 3/4 of Americans say they regularly experience physiological and psychological symptoms caused by stress. Research shows that Generation Z, in particular, is much less able to manage and deal with stress. Feelings of fear, trepidation, and hesitance keep them from performing as well as they could. A lunch with NASCAR driver Joey Logano might fix that for them. It did for me. Joey loves pressure. In fact, Joey thinks pressure is a privilege. "I don't think about ways I can screw this up or how this might be my only shot," he told me. It's not going to be my only shot. I'm only 26. I have time left. I will work hard to make sure I get more moments like this. I love having that do-or-die moment. Do what the pros do. Find a person who challenges you. Find a person who lays out a process so seemingly daunting, so seemingly insurmountable. A course wherein the there seems insurmountable, but so does the here, and who helps you achieve something you never dreamed you could. By now, you might be tired of hearing me talk about Jeremiah Bishop and the time I wrote his Gran Fondo. You might be, but I'm not. Jeremiah helped me accomplish something incredibly hard and gave me the confidence to try other extremely challenging things. How did I download as much of his expertise onto my mental hard drive as possible? That sinking feeling means you're on the right track. You know the sensation. The sinking feeling you get in the pit of your stomach when an idea initially sounded great, but now the cold, stark, horrifying reality has set in. I do. Big time. In a moment of weakness, hubris, lunacy, you choose, each is correct, I decided to prove I was right. And because I figured the bigger the goal, the more right I would therefore be, I made my first mistake. I called Jeremiah Bishop. Jeremiah is basically to mountain bike racing what an NBA All-Star is to basketball. For years, he has been one of the most versatile and accomplished riders in the world. He's won the Pan American Games, did the double in 2008 by winning the U.S. short track cross country and the marathon mountain bike national championships, and was a 12-time member of the U.S. national team. I told him I was looking for a nearly impossible, at least for me, physical challenge. Maybe I could train for and ride a mass participation event, or possibly complete in a certain time a route he devised for me, or what else? I didn't know. I had recently started riding a road bike to try to get in better shape, and aside from seeking a challenge that involved cycling, I didn't have any real ideas. But he did. Ride his inaugural Alpine Loop Gran Fondo. At first, the idea didn't seem too bad. 107 miles sounded long, but at least in theory, manageable. Serious cycling enthusiasts routinely complete century rides of 100 miles or more. Except that even for serious enthusiasts, his event was savage. The route followed his favorite hardcore training ride and included paved climbs over two mountains plus dirt road climbs over two more mountains. One climb used a dirt gravel fire access road that crests Reddish Knob at 4,400 feet, one of the highest points in Virginia. As Jeremiah told me, think of it like completing a marathon, as long as that marathon also involves running up and over a mountain. Daunting enough for a guy who had been riding a bike for less than a month, but it got better, or worse, depending on your perspective. I had a little over 3 months to get ready. And that's how that sinking feeling in my stomach soon became my new best friend. Because he had agreed to be my pro, the first step was to take a ride with Jeremiah so he could evaluate my fitness and form. We rode a few miles before Jeremiah chose a short but relatively steep hill to gauge my current level of fitness. Within moments, my heart rate had soared to 160 beats per minute, flirted briefly with the 170s, and finally settled firmly into the 180s. Because in theory, my maximum heart rate should have been no more than 170 or so, 184 beats per minute was what exercise physiologists generally call high. My vision tunneled. I felt that nauseous and woozy, I'm about to faint, and that's actually cool with me because lying on the ground sounds really, really appealing feeling. Before I did, though, fatigue made a coward out of me, as fatigue is wont to do, and I stopped about 30 feet from the top of the hill. I sagged over my handlebars and managed to glance sideways at Jeremiah's heart rate monitor. It read 125 beats per minute. At that moment, I learned three more things. One, having a pro also means your pro is a freaking pro. Two, when you think your pro is speaking to you, he may actually be narrating the video he's recording of your near-death state. Three, your pro can get you to where you want to go because he won't coddle you or tell you what you want to hear. He'll tell you what you need to hear and need to do. That's because your pro will often simply lay out what other highly successful people did to achieve that level of success. People you will never meet. For example, Stephen King writes 2,000 words a day, and as he says in his book On Writing, A Memoir of the Craft, only under dire circumstances will he allow himself to shut down before he gets his 2,000 words. Yep, the Kingster works his number. If you want to be a writer, you could do a lot worse than simply doing what that pro does. That's why you don't need a coach. You don't need someone to encourage you, to coddle you, to adapt their knowledge and skills and expertise to your capabilities. You need someone to say, this is how I do it, and then let you do it. Coaches coach, and they're great if that's what you want. But if you want to accomplish what the pros have accomplished, you don't need a coach. You need a pro. All you have to do is choose people who have accomplished things that you wish to accomplish and follow their leads. The blueprint is there. If you're into fitness, workout plans abound. If you're into business, biographies abound. If you want to learn a particular skill, the blueprints are there. Just be willing to follow them. Don't think you can somehow hack your way to the same level of success. You aren't that smart. I'm not that smart. Maybe Tim Ferriss is that smart, but there's only one Tim Ferriss. Ask him. He'll tell you. Just playing, Tim. So, no, you don't need to know the pro you emulate. How to pick your pro. Whom you choose to admire, and it is a choice, says more about you than about that person. We tend to admire certain people because we see something of ourselves in them. We like to think that what they do and how they do it indicates what we would do if given the chance. Say you're a tech entrepreneur. You may admire Mark Zuckerberg for staying the course and reportedly turning down a $1 billion offer from Yahoo. Or you may admire Mark Cuban because he cashed out by selling Broadcast.com to Yahoo for more than $5 billion just a few years after co-founding the company. Maybe your hero is Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx, who, and this is even more difficult, is raising 4 children. Maybe you admire Sheryl Sandberg because she's a successful businesswoman or because she works tirelessly to help women and men find ways to lead more fulfilling and successful lives. Or maybe you admire her for both reasons. Maybe your hero is Richard Branson. If you were a billionaire, you would be an adventure-seeking, publicity-generating machine, too. But keep in mind that for Branson, experiencing adventure was the primary purpose. It was the adventure that was irresistible, basically, he told me. But there was the byproduct that Virgin as a brand became an adventurous brand, a sexy brand, and I think some of these adventures did actually help with that. Today, Virgin is one of the better-known brands in the world. It punches quite a long way above its weight compared with its turnover and profits. I had a lot of fun, incredible adventures, and the byproduct from a branding point of view was positive as well. Or maybe you'd take an opposite approach and choose Brad Kelly as your hero. If you were a billionaire who owned more land than the area of Rhode Island, you would make sure no one has heard of you either. It doesn't matter whom you admire. It doesn't matter whom you look to for inspiration. You're seeking more of a blueprint for success. Whom you choose is important only in that their approach to success will help you achieve your goals. You can even take a counterintuitive approach and think well outside the hero box. Think of someone who is extremely successful, but whom you would normally never dream of emulating. If you're shy and reserved, pick a relentless self-promoter. If you love shooting from the hip, pick someone known for thorough analysis. If you always seek to build consensus through compromise, pick someone who often takes a bold stand. Then, pick a specific skill, quality, or attribute, and do something the way that person would do it. It won't be comfortable. It won't feel natural. But it will stretch you and take you to places you otherwise never would have gone. And then, if what you've done so far hasn't taken you where you want to go, take a bigger swing at the emulation target. Learn as much as you can about that person and adopt as many of their habits and routines as you possibly can. The difference between pros and motivational coaches. My first week of cycling training, my pro was in Italy racing in the UCI Mountain Bike Marathon World Championships. Granted, my situation was different because Jeremiah is a professional athlete. But the average cycling coach works with athletes from afar, emailing training plans, reviewing training logs, checking in remotely, etc. In fact, cycling coaches are emblematic of the sport and of life. Responsibility rests squarely on the cyclist, not the coach. Cycling coaches advise, mentor, and motivate, but like a supervisor overseeing remote teams or a business owner managing multiple locations, they cannot and do not directly supervise or enforce. And my pro had zero interest in supervising me, even if he did have the time. That's one of the reasons he excels in his sport. From his perspective, anyone who states a goal must naturally be willing to do whatever it takes to achieve that goal. That's why there are coaches and there are pros. Coaches think about making the process fun and uplifting. Pros show you how to succeed and expect you to take full responsibility for your own success. Pros will help you stop believing that making a few small tweaks will somehow change your life. Pros will help you stop believing that you can just do a little bit more of what you have always done and somehow that minor change will make all the difference. I stopped trying to just think positively. I stopped setting only reachable goals. I stopped thinking I could somehow hack my way to success. I didn't do all the stuff we're told to do because all the stuff we're told to do never, ever works. Take a different approach. Ask someone who has been there and done that, a real pro, what they would do in your shoes. And then do what they tell you to do, because unlike most people, however well-meaning they may be, a pro knows. "I can't believe I did that" is incredibly powerful. You start to crave that feeling. You start to crave the suffering, whether physical or mental, because you crave that feeling of accomplishment when you finish the day's routine. You look forward to the pain because it is followed by the joy of success. And in time, while you may never be as accomplished as the pro you emulate, you will be a member of the club. You will become a cyclist or a runner or a leader or an entrepreneur or a philanthropist or whatever it is you set out to be. And that feels amazing too. Because when you've become something, you need almost no motivation at all in order to keep being what you have become. It's no longer what you do, it's what you are. How to connect with your pro. Some people prefer not to emulate from afar. Some prefer direct contact and the sense of connection it imparts. That approach means finding a pro who will work with or mentor you. The process starts with finding a way to fit in with the community you hope to join. Leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, fitness enthusiasts, etc. Fortunately, that's a natural urge. We all want to feel like we're part of a community or that we're part of something larger than ourselves. But if you're like me, fitting in is not so easy. For one thing, I'm shy. I'm fairly introverted in informal group settings. Though I don't mind speaking to crowds at all, as many introverts know, that's different. I'm hardly brimming with natural self-confidence unless I'm in the right setting. As it is with many people, my self-confidence is largely situational. So when I realized being cycling scrawny, 6 feet tall, 150 pounds, is great for road cycling, but is far from the healthiest of looks, I joined a gym. I started lifting weights. I felt like a fish, totally out of water. Any upper body strength I'd once had was long gone. No one was lifting less weight than I was. I hated it. I felt like whoever looked at me was judging me. Not that many people were looking. Most, especially the big boys, brushed past me as if I weren't there. But I stuck with it and got a little stronger. I got a little bigger. In time, I was able to lift more weight for more reps and more sets. That helped me get a little stronger and a little bigger, too. That's how it works. One day, an archetype of a gym rat, shaved head, cut-off shirt, veins like ropes in his arms, was doing side-to-side pull-ups, hands close together, looking along the bar rather than facing it, pulling up and alternating, bringing his head above the bar on the right side and then the left. I was looking for different exercises to do, and I'm not sure what possessed me, but when he finished his set, I said, "I've never seen pull-ups done that way. Where are you feeling them?" As soon as the words were out of my mouth, I thought, "Oh, great, he's going to blow me off." Instead, he smiled. "Yeah, those are really hard," he said. "I definitely feel them in my lats, but I like how it brings my core into it. You should try them." I said, "Thanks," and started to walk away. "Hey," he said, "I've noticed you often change the width of your grip when you do dips. Why is that?" In that moment, several things flashed through my mind. One, I was surprised he'd even noticed how I did dips. Two, I was shocked he was asking me for advice. And three, in an environment where I had always felt a little uncomfortable and a lot insecure, I was evidently starting to fit in. And cheesy as it might sound, that felt really good. 25 pounds with no increase in body fat percentage later, I no longer feel like I don't fit in. I'm far from the biggest or strongest, and that was never my goal. But it is really nice to exchange hellos, to exchange nods, to ask questions or give a little advice. I've become a member of a small community of people with a shared interest and a shared purpose. Fitting in feels good. Even somewhere relatively meaningless and insignificant like a small-town gym. So how can you fit in when you don't feel you belong, whether in a group, an organization, or even a workplace? It just takes the right approach. Start quietly and just do the work. We've all been in situations where that guy, it's always a guy, shows up for the first time and immediately tries to force his way into a group. Don't be that guy. Say you join an industry organization. Show up for every meeting. Contribute in small ways, but otherwise lie low. Show that you recognize you're new. Show that you don't expect to be taken seriously until you prove you're serious and are in it for the long haul. Volunteer for the worst jobs. That guy tries to leapfrog his way to the plum tasks. Sometimes he even manages to pull it off, but the cost, in terms of belonging, is high. Instead, use the time you're lying low to figure out where you can make the biggest difference to the people in the group. Hint, just find ways to make their lives easier. Volunteer for the grunt work. Volunteer for the glory-free tasks. Volunteer to pay your dues. Ask for help that requires only words. That guy goes to a networking event and moments after meeting you wants an introduction to someone you know, or wants you to wrangle him an appointment with one of your customers, or wants you to, well, you know how it goes. We all need help. We all need assistance. But once you've paid some dues, be smart and start small. Don't ask for time or effort. Just ask a question. Offer to help in ways that require more than words. That guy immediately walks over and tells you what you're doing wrong, or what you could be doing better, or could be doing differently, or most likely, what you should be doing his way. That kind of help is more about that guy than about you, much less about what you may actually need. Pay attention so you'll notice when other people are struggling. Then come up with specific ways to help. That way, you can push past the automatic, "No, I'm okay," responses. Very few people offer help before they have been asked, even though most of the time that is when a little help will make the greatest impact. Just make sure you offer to roll up your sleeves and really help. That's the only way to make a real difference in another person's life. Help other people feel they belong. Think of it this way. No matter how welcoming and new employee friendly the company, recently hired employees often feel they're constantly being weighed, measured, and found wanting. Maybe it's the guy in shipping who always eats lunch alone. Maybe it's the lady in accounting who always stands at the edge of a group. It's easy to spot people who feel hesitant and out of place. Pick one. Say hi. Say something nice. Say or do something that makes the person feel a slightly bigger connection to the company, to a group, or just to you. Reach the point at which you feel confident helping others fit in. And that's when you truly fit in. Because then, it's no longer about you. It's about the group and the people in that group. Which, when you think about it, is the perfect definition of fitting in. And which, when you think even harder about it, is the perfect time to ask someone you admire how they gained the skill or expertise they possess and how you can too. I promise they won't ignore your request because you've proven yourself as someone who helps others, which means people will gladly help you. Who you look to for inspiration is important, but what really matters is that their approach to success will help you achieve your goals and that their success and their approach to achieving that success will serve as an example to help you overcome your self-imposed limits. Your biggest limits are self-imposed, but those limits are the easiest to overcome. Granted, we all have limits. Some limits are physical, some are mental, some we simply can't do anything about. But in most cases, our limits are self-imposed. Here's an example of a self-imposed limit. Effort. It's easy to rationalize that we've done enough. It's tempting to think we've done all we can, especially when we're tired, and so we stop. But that little voice lies. With the right motivation or under the right circumstances, we can always do more. Stopping is nearly always a choice. We don't have to stop. We choose to stop. The same is true for skill. Once you reach a certain level of expertise, your rate of improvement typically slows, and it's natural to assume you're near your limit. But you really aren't. You just think so because you've started comparing your present self with your past self instead of what is actually possible. You've started to look back at how far you've come instead of looking forward to see just how far you can still go. You assume you're as good as you're likely to ever be. And so, often unconsciously, you stop trying. Here's a great example. Last year, I went to a go-kart track with some NASCAR executives and three actual racers. Alan Day, Euro NASCAR Series driver and 2016 Israeli Athlete of the Year. Ty Majeski, 2016 ARCA Midwest Tour Champion. And Ross Chastain, Xfinity Series driver. Occasional truck series driver, and all-around good guy. I've been to kart tracks before and typically finish well compared with other weekend warriors, but against three professional drivers? On the very first practice lap, they all flashed past me going into a series of S-turns. I knew they would be fast, but their speed seemed surreal. I couldn't imagine ever going that fast. But I settled in and tried to find the best lines, the best braking points. Practice is all about experimenting. I did my best and finished the practice session with the fifth quickest time out of 10 people. I was about half a second behind a non-racer. Not bad. Except Alan, Ty, and Ross were nearly 5 seconds faster. Ugh. While we took a break, the other non-racers chatted with one another. I went straight to Ross and asked him how he was so quick. He looked out at the track for a moment. "Were you flat out through the S's?" he asked. No, I said, narrowing my eyes with skepticism. Pedal to the metal on a tight track might seem fast, but it's usually not. In some places on a track, you have to go slow in order to be fast. I didn't think I could. "Sure you can," he said. "Go in wide, tap the inside corner of the first turn, then tap the wall just before the narrowest point on the next one. That's the line you want to take. The back end might slide a little on the exit of the last turn, and you may kiss the wall, but that's okay." "Okay," I thought. "Easy for your NASCAR driver ass to say." Oddly enough, though, it was easy for my skeptical ass to actually do. On my first qualifying lap, I used the line he recommended and entered the first S-turn flat out and never had to lift off the throttle. That alone made me much faster because I carried extra speed into the straightaway and through the following right-hand sweeper. What changed? My skill wasn't the problem. My self-imposed limit was the problem. I didn't think it was possible to go flat out, so it wasn't. Once I knew it was possible, it was possible. Nothing changed except my perspective and, as a result, my skill. I had stopped thinking about going a little faster than I had earlier and started thinking about trying to be as fast as Ross. I was no longer my benchmark. Ross was my benchmark. After qualifying and using a few other tips Ross gave me about a few other turns, I was fourth fastest behind Alan, Ross, and Ty. With a little more practice, their lap times had improved by about half a second more than the practice session. My lap times had improved by more than 3 seconds. For the race, we lined up in qualifying order, 10 feet separating each cart. As the laps wound down, Alan, Ross, and Ty gradually eased into the distance. I did manage to lap all but one of the other carts and kept from being lapped by the fast guys. But for the most part, I just tried to race the track and drive the way Ross would. Of course, I couldn't, but I tried because he was my benchmark. And that mental shift made me faster. My fastest lap was almost a second quicker than my best qualifying lap because I forgot my self-imposed limits and instead focused on trying to achieve what was actually possible. And you can do the same. Stop comparing yourself with yourself. Stop comparing yourself with the people around you. Go see a superstar in action, whether it's a speaker, a musician, a performer, an athlete, or an entrepreneur. Find a way to expose yourself to exceptional skill, exceptional expertise, and exceptional talent. I've ridden with professional cyclists. The experience, while humbling, automatically ratcheted my performance bar higher. I've worked with one of the queens of data analysis. The experience, while humbling, automatically ratcheted my own problem-solving expectations much higher. When you spend time with a superstar, when you try to do what the pros do, that experience will automatically ratchet your own internal limits to a higher level. While you may never be as good when superstar performance is your bar, you automatically set your goals higher, and that makes you achieve more. Stop comparing your present self with your past self. Start comparing your present self, regardless of how far you think you have already come, with what is actually possible. Stop looking back. Start looking forward to see how far you can still go. And then work hard to get there. Do what the pros do. You may never be as talented as the absolute best in the field or pursuit you choose, but you will definitely achieve much more than your self-imposed limits allowed you to think was ever possible. To accomplish a huge goal, go Viking. Clive Standen is the actor who plays Rollo on Vikings and Brian Mills on the NBC show Taken. Because of Vikings, he may seem like an overnight success, but he had been an actor for many years before getting that role. How did he hang in there during the lean times? "I'm a husband and the father of three kids," he told me. "I have the pressure of putting food on the table. The cliche is that when you have kids, you stop worrying about yourself, but you really do. Becoming a parent changed everything for me. When things aren't going so well, you simply do whatever it takes. When I was struggling, I had no pride in terms of what jobs I would take. I drove vans, passed out things on the street, waited tables, did bar work, cleaned houses. The mortgage doesn't pay itself. That was motivation enough. On the flip side, having kids gives you less time to devote to putting food on the table. When you have kids, you think you'll have less time, but I actually find more time. We waste so many hours in the day procrastinating. Nowadays, those hours when the kids are at school are the ones that I make sure I use to get the work done. I don't want to take away from time with the kids. I don't waste it. I use that time. I find myself getting far more done as a parent because I seize those opportunities. Ultimately, I do everything for my family. Even if it means staying up all night, you make the time. If you're struggling to manage your time effectively, Clive's is the perfect approach. Decide what is important to you and then structure your life and your process to ensure you accomplish the things that really matter. As for hanging in there, as you put it, Clive continues, Richard Briers came to our drama school and we asked him a similar question. How do you hang in there? How do you get through the hard times? He said, if you really, 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 really want to act, don't. But if you have to act, then do it. It's not as easy as saying, well, it's not working out, so what else am I good at? That's another motivation for me. There is nothing else I am as good at as acting that satisfies that hunger as much. So I didn't have a choice. I had to hang in there. Do you have a choice? If your goal means enough to you, then you don't. Act that way. Hanging in there and staying the course will help fuel your motivation to continue. But what if you lack confidence? What if that's holding you back? Emulate someone like Tamara Taylor, the star of Bones. As a child, Tamara was painfully shy. What did she do about it? She decided to try acting in order to overcome her fear. Although, as you'll see, overcome is the wrong word because, as for many of us, confidence isn't just a switch for Tamara that, once flipped, stays on forever. Confidence is earned each and every day, and the process often starts when you dive in and do what you're most afraid to do. I know it sounds crazy, but it made sense for me, Tamara told me. One, I love movies, and that still quiet part of myself thought I might be good at acting if I tried it. But that was also the thing that scared me the most. I was so shy, it almost paralyzed me in social settings. And as shy people know, that can become a vicious cycle. The more uncomfortable you feel around people, the more you retreat, and the more shy you get. Fortunately, my best friend in the world had moved to Los Angeles and gotten a part on a hit TV show, and I thought, if only I could do that. So I got into an acting class because it scared me to my core. The glorious surprise was I actually loved acting. It took many years of acting classes to get even remotely comfortable, but that's okay. It helped me so much on a personal level, not to mention professionally. Tamara also has an awesome perspective on staying the course and how even the smallest successes helped fuel her motivation. The key to my perseverance was absolutely loving the craft of acting, she said. I just figured that if I kept doing it, at the very least, I would get better at acting. even if I didn't become a tremendous success. So long as I knew I was improving and getting better, to me, that was success. Feeling successful is internal, not external. There's that Steve Jobs quote that says the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do. And it does require a little bit of crazy to say the light is green when the world is telling you the light is red. The world tells lots of people the light is red. You have to trust yourself and say, I think the light is green, and I'm going to keep doing this. As long as you keep going, you'll keep getting better. And as you get better, you gain more confidence. That alone to me is success. See, it's easy to find pros to emulate. What is harder is committing to do what the pros do, but it's not nearly so hard when you realize how well it works. Embrace the challenge. Embrace the pain. Embrace the fact that you will stretch and push yourself beyond your normal limits, because every time you do, you'll feel motivated to do it again. And in time, you'll find yourself living the life you want to live. Chapter 8. Do more by doing less. We've talked a lot about success. We've talked a lot about achievement. We've looked at plenty of examples of extremely accomplished, often even famous, people and how they achieved that success. They're great. We all dream of being great, but we can't all be great at everything. But we can be the best we can be at the things we choose to do. That's how every successful person starts out. They don't know they'll be superstars. They don't know they'll be world class. They just know they want to be as good as they can be. Be the biggest fish. Say you're speaking at an event. Your goal is to be the best speaker at that event. You don't have to be as good as Tony Robbins, who, for all the fun I poke at him, is a tremendous speaker. You just need to be the best speaker at that event. You need to stand out from the other speakers. You need to be special in some way. Funnier, smarter, more enthusiastic, more insightful. You need to be the person at that event who provides the best value to the audience. Then people will remember you. Then people will check out your other work. Then other conferences will want to book you. Being the best naturally creates greater opportunities. Or say you attend a meeting. Your goal isn't to be the Stephen Covey of meetings. Your goal is to be the most prepared, or the most on point, or the most knowledgeable, or the most engaged. Your goal is to be the best person attending that meeting. Or say you work in customer service. While you ultimately may want to prove that you have the potential to hold higher level positions, your immediate goal is to be the best in your company at what you currently do, or barring that, to be the best at some aspect of your job. That's how you stand out. That's how you get noticed. That's how you move up the ladder of achievement. That's how you get the skills, expertise, and experience you might not gain if you settle for being average. And that's also how you become part of a community and become who you want to be. This be the best principle can be applied anywhere. Take me. I sometimes go on rides with local riders who are not only younger, but also professional cyclists. Add that to the list of ways it sucks to be me. When I'm riding with the fast guys, I will never be the best cyclist. But I can be the most helpful person on the ride. I can be the guy who takes the longest lead outs into a headwind. Or I can be the guy who always brings extra tubes and CO2 cartridges in case someone else has a flat and didn't bring theirs. Or I can be the best, he's pretty slow, but he's entertaining to have along, guy. So that's what I do. I find some way to be the best. It's more fun for me and for the people I ride with. I've become a better cyclist just by riding with the fast guys. And I feel welcomed in a setting where I otherwise would never feel I belonged. We all have our sweet spot, yet most of us spend a fraction of our day actually working in our sweet spots. The key is to find ways to delegate or streamline all the tasks that distract you from doing what you do best. Because when you do more of what you do best, you achieve more. And your career, or your business, or your personal life naturally flourishes. How can you free up time so you can apply other achievement strategies to the things you do best and learn to perform those things even better than you already do? That's hard. Because if you're already somewhat successful, success tends to create clutter. More meetings, more projects, more decisions, more items on your to-do list. But often doing more can mean achieving less. That's why, once again, subtraction can be the best addition, especially when you streamline your day and, in the process, your life. And the easiest way to do that is to start saying no. The anti-drug commercials are right. Just say no. As an employee, as a business owner, as a parent or friend, you constantly say yes to opportunities, to ideas, to things you can do to help other people and make a difference in their lives. Saying yes is a crucial element in your success. But so is saying no. In fact, if you want to achieve a huge goal as well as succeed at all your other responsibilities, you need to learn how to say no to most things that come your way. Otherwise, other people and other choices will place incredible demands on your most valuable resource, your time. Ryan Robinson, a serial entrepreneur and marketer, uses a simple framework for deciding whether to say yes or no. He asks himself two questions. Will doing this benefit me in some way? Of course, benefits come in many forms. Benefits may be financial. Benefits may be professional. Benefits may be in the form of greater fulfillment, greater satisfaction, the joy of doing good. Just as the definition of success is unique to each person, so is the definition of benefits. That means only you can decide whether a certain opportunity, activity, or request benefits you. Say you're asked to speak at an event. That may be a cool opportunity, but what if the only benefit to you involves your ego? If you have nothing better to do, go for it. But shouldn't you use that time to do more of what you do best? Or say you could throw your name in the hat to serve on your company's employee picnic team. Yes, those do exist. That may be a cool opportunity, but then again, probably not. Your time would be better spent focused on areas that drive real value for your organization. No matter what your business, one or two things truly drive results. Maybe it's quality. Maybe it's service. Maybe it's being the lowest cost provider. Maybe it's the personal connection made with each individual customer. Other aspects are important, but for every business, one or two are absolutely make or break. Want to succeed? Spend all the time you can working on the area that drives real value for your business. That's how you'll stand out. That's what you should do best and do more of. Ruthlessly evaluate every opportunity that comes your way. Remember, every time you say yes, you take time away from doing what you do best. Make sure that yes is genuinely worth it. Is this more important than what I'm currently doing? Now the rubber meets the road. You already have non-negotiable goals, meeting your basic financial needs, meeting your basic health needs, taking care of your family. If the opportunity negatively impacts those things, boom, automatic no. But what about your negotiable goals? Here it gets stickier, but not really. Which is more important to you, the opportunity or what you are currently working to achieve? The answer is always easier than you think. If you decided to, say, run a marathon and you've been working hard and following your routine, There's no reason to switch fitness goals in midstream. You'll achieve your goal of running a marathon, and then you can put on your serial achiever hat and achieve a different goal. And you'll bring the confidence and motivation you've gained